This is a Pinball News production.
You know, I'm kind of embarrassed. Sounds like I'm playing hard to get or something like that, but you got to understand, you think of me as kind of this business guy in that I'm really an engineer. I like to invent stuff. And you can't invent stuff when you're on airplanes running around the world. And so it's always a trade-off. But I thought I'd start out a little bit with some history. People kind of like that. I was putting myself through college, and I started, well, maybe I can go back a little bit. I started out as an entrepreneur as 9 years old because I was a ham radio operator. And I got really fascinated with ham radio. But if you wanted to buy the radios and the transmitters or even the parts to them, you divided your lawnmower money, lawn mowing money, and your allowance. And I figured that I could get the stuff I wanted when I turned 35. That was not acceptable to me. So I figured out how to do something else. And so I was kind of always big for my age. And so I started repairing TVs. And that was my first business, Bushnell Repair. And I charged 50 cents for a house call. But I really learned how to mark up the tubes. So I later on started an advertising company, and it was basically around putting together a calendar of events and advertising around it. And the economics were simple. I'd sell $3,000 worth of advertising. This is when $3,000 was a lot of money. And I'd print them up for $500 and give them away at the beginning of the school year. And it was a great, great business. But I had an ability to spend money that was prodigious. And so I decided the only way I was going to be able to save the money I made in the summer was to get a fun night job, not to make that much money, because it was a minimum wage, you know, 75 cents an hour, but to keep me out of harm's way. And it worked like a charm. But turned out that I was good at it, and ended up managing the amusement park, that amusement park's game center, which was, I had 28 midway games, 150 kids working for me, and two arcades. That's really important because the two arcades gave me the understanding of what a coin-operated game needed to make and about how much they cost. Then, at the University of Utah, that video screen right there on a PDP-1 was magical. A guy named Steve Russell at MIT in 1962 programmed a game called Space War. In 1966, I saw the game. I was working in the amusement park summers. Saw that game in the middle of the night because we had to sneak in to steal computer time. We'd jimmy the locks, keep the lights off, and play. It was really bad on my grades, but that's okay. And I thought, if I could put that screen in my arcade, it would make a lot of money. But then I divided into $1 million computer, 25 cents a play. The math didn't work. Put that away, and then later on, graduated from college, went to work in Silicon Valley, and I figured out, and then all of a sudden, the cost of chips just plummeted. And what used to cost hundreds of dollars, I could all of a sudden buy for 15 cents a chip. The world changed. So, Computer Quiz was a product by Nutting Associates. I put together a prototype. The rocket ship could only go up, but it looked cool. And I went to my dentist appointment and told him about my project. He says, there's a company in Mountain View doing a thing called a computer quiz that's in the coin-operated game business. I'll introduce you. So I met the guy and showed him the prototype, and he says, we need to hire you. So I was making $825 a month as an associate engineer, and they came and I showed them the prototype, and they said, yeah, we'll license it. And so I got a 5% royalty deal and got the license, and they said, come and be our chief engineer. I said, I don't know, I'm pretty expensive. And they said, how much? And I figured, well, if I can double my salary, I'll do it. So I said, $1,600 a month. They said, yes, too fast. And so, and a company car. So, anyway, that was how computer space came about. And the girl in this thing was a topless dancer down the street. And it basically used the technology that we're dealing with. And the experience with Nutting was really good because they sent me to all kinds of training sessions to teach the distributors how to deal with this new technology. And I got to know the distributors, and all the distributors kind of said, Nutting is a little bit weird. We don't think that's the best place to buy stuff from, but we like your products. But they always had this sort of attitude. And pretty soon I started noticing that the guys that were running Nutting at the time were about as smart as a sack of hammers. And so it became clear that that wasn't where I should, you know, hitch my star. So let me go back. So I decided, and this was fall 1971. This was on the market. We went to the AMOA, sold a lot of units, about 2,000. It wasn't, you know, but I think we were selling to, for $1,200. So it was about $2.5 million, which I thought was a big win. It actually was not bad at that time. But I decided I wanted to figure out a way to do something more. So I went to Nutting and said, I need a big stock option. I want to be a big portion of the company. And I want more say in how this place is managed. And they said, no, you stay in the engineering department and that sort of thing. So I decided I got to get out of this madhouse. So during the time, I had started a route. I bought the prototypes of the computer space, put them on locations. They earned like a lot of money around college campuses. And then I bought some pinballs. And so we had a pretty good cash flow going. I had the royalties from computer space. And I decided I needed a little bit more for cash flow. So I flew. I had an appointment to teach a training session at Empire Distributing here in Chicago. And I asked Gil Kitt, I don't know how many of you remember Gil? Yeah. Gil Kitt, I said, I need to meet a mucky muck at Bally. And he said, great. He took me over. So while I was doing the test, he took me over to Bally, and I said, I did computer space. I want to do a driving game for you, but you're going to have to pay for it. I got a contract with them to do a driving game, and came back and resigned from Nutting and said, I'd like a contract to design the next game for you. And I got a contract for two-player computer space. And I had my cash flow covered. Started the business, rented 1,000 square feet on Scott Boulevard, hired Al Alcorn. Now, I'm a pretty good engineer, Al Alcorn is a genius. He is really, really good. And the day that he was going to show up for work, I had heard that there was a great big company that was entering the video game business. I said, oh my God, my life is wrecked. I thought I was alone because Computer Space was the only video game that had existed at that time. And so I went up, saw the Magnavox game, and thought, well, this is pretty crappy. I'm not too worried. But I kind of looked around and I thought, hey, people are kind of having fun with it. Maybe if I take this ping pong game, dress it up, do some of our tricks to it, I'll have an interesting game. But I said, it's probably not commercial. So I came back, and the Computer Space technology was pretty complex, and so I told Al Alcorn to, let's create a pong game. And I described the game, and literally in 2 weeks he had the thing working. Another 2 weeks we'd modified it a little bit. We'd added sound, we'd had added score, the speed up algorithms, and it was pretty good. And so we started having a lot of fun with it. This is backwards. This is a London control. So anyway, that was me. Al is on with the beard, clear on the left. My partner, Ted Dabney, on the right. And this is Fred, who was our first financial guy who we fired, and I'm not going to tell you why. There were two innovations here. One was the polka dot shirt. The polka dot shirt did not catch on. I got thinking, this is a pretty good game. I got on an airplane, flew to Chicago, went into Bally, said, how would you like this instead of the driving game? Thinking I could complete the contract ahead of time, no harm, no foul. They looked at it and said, well, you know, it's only a two-player game. We don't think that's going to be that great. But let me think about it. But why don't you go over to Midway, because they just purchased Midway at the time, and I presented it to them. Hank Ross and Iggy Wolverton, remember those guys? Boy, I know that this is a stretch, blast to the past. But they said the same thing. It's a two-player game. It's kind of a fun game, but I don't think it's commercial. But let me think about it. So I get on the airplane, come back, and while I was in Chicago, Al and Ted had put it on location at Anticap's Tavern. 3 days after they put it on location, they said, well, how do we know whether we've got a good game? I said, well, you know, if it can do $5 a day, you've got a reasonable business. If you've got $10 a day, it's a great business. If you've got $20 a day, it's never happened before. This was in the early 70s. Well, all of a sudden, 4 or 5 days into the test, the machine failed. Got a call, says this machine does no longer work. So they went down, opened it up. The cash box had been completely filled up and could not take any quarters. I thought to myself, we can fix this problem. So totally full of quarters. Well, all of a sudden, fear turned into greed. And I figured out that we had enough cash to build exactly 13 units. 13 was unlucky, so we decided to build 12. And And I thought, and the mathematics said, if we can't sell them, I'll put them on the route, and they're making enough money, they'll pay for themselves, I'm a happy guy. But I was under contract with Bally, and I'd already offered to him. So I called up Bally, and I said, Midway doesn't want it. They'd rather have the driving game. What about you? They said, yeah. And then I called up Midway and said, Bally doesn't want the Pong game. They want the driving game, too. Is that okay? Yeah. So now all of a sudden, I've got Pong free and clear, rock and roll. And we start production. And we build the 12. Next time we did 36. Next time we did 48. And then I told Al, we're going to go up to 100 a day. And he says, are you crazy? We don't have no manufacturing. I said, yeah, but we can rent stuff. So we rented 30,000 square foot abandoned roller skating ring. We found that we could move the cabinets on skateboards. Now, to say the least, this was a very atypical company. So when you say, why weren't you able to raise any money? We were crazy. But we started out, and it turned out that it was pretty good. What a lot of people don't realize is that Pong was massively copied. The good news was any little company with a garage shop could build Pong, because that's what we had. The bad news is there was a lot of them, and they found out, and we couldn't keep up with the demand. And so, you know, we figured there were about 160,000 Pong-type games manufactured, of which we did about 15,000 of them, which was really great for us, but it could have been a lot better. And so we decided that the way everybody had better factories, more money, more fun, and so that our only answer was to out-innovate everybody else. Magnavox Odyssey, around the same time, came into the consumer market. They had a huge return problem because a lot of people who were buying the Odyssey thought they were buying Pong, got it home, and were unhappy. And this is kind of interesting because it ultimately really hurt us later on. But this is the consumer Pong when we shipped it. And then, we did the Atari VCS. Now, you got to understand, when we took the Pong game to the toy fair in New York, we sold zero. You say, what? Well, the toy companies all thought that the most expensive toy that they had was $29. We were asking a retail price of $79. Gene Lipkin, how many know Gene Lipkin here? You know? Wow, you guys are a lot younger than I thought you were. Anyway, Gene was a consummate sales marketing guy. And we tried going with TV guys, we tried doing that, and we were kind of getting nervous about it. It was about 2 months after the Atari, the toy show. And he called Sears Sporting Goods. And it turns out that Sears does home pool tables, ping pong tables in the winter. And the year before, they had a consumer pinball that they totally sold out. And so the buyer thought, aha, pinball, pongs are in bars. Pinballs are in bars, pool tables are in bars. This is the right thing. So he called him, and the next day, the buyer was on our doorstep in Los Gatos. And he came in and he said, you know, I'm kind of interested in this Pong product. we were sitting around, and he says, well, you know, how many can you build? We had no clue. We hadn't really thought about it that much. So I said, let me get back to you on that. So we went out and huddled in the thing. My head of manufacturing says, I think we can do 25,000. So I said, went back into him. I said, I think we can do about 75,000. Then he said, then the next day, he gave us a purchase order for 150,000. What I didn't understand is the power of the plausible possible. The minute you think about it and you start saying, okay, we got an order for 150,000, is there any possibility we can do it? And then all of a sudden you say, okay, we're going to do two cavities in the plastic molding instead of, you know, turns out the electronics was easy. The damn plastic almost drove us batshit. But it turns out that when you start changing the dynamics of the way you think, two assembly lines instead of one, all this stuff, and all of a sudden you say, maybe we can do that. And then you start munching the numbers, and I had to call, and I said, Tom, there's no way we can fund this. We don't have any cash. He says, oh, not to worry. I'll introduce you to Sears Bank. And I said, what, Sears Bank? Yeah. He says, yeah. We'll create a bonded warehouse at the end of your production line, and we'll advance you 90% of your wholesale price every time a finished product drops into the bonded warehouse. So all of a sudden, we had cash flow. We built the factory, we got it going, and we were off to the races. And during that year, before Christmas, we shipped 235,000 consumer pongs. Yeah, we planned it. But, you know, every once in a while, things kind of work well for you. Anyway. Then came the VCS. The VCS, well, I should say, I had a couple of slides here. Who remembers the video pinball? We had this idea of doing these custom games. And the year we did video pinball, we did Stunt Cycle, which is a little motorcycle game. These were all games. But they were all like $70 for a single game. And we knew that could not continue, so we decided, and to put it in context, the microprocessor had just started to be fast enough to deal with video rates. Along with the custom chip and the microprocessor, and because the 6502 had an instruction set that was really good for the kinds of stuff we were doing. And we figured out that we could do a programmable game with cartridges. And so it went from consumer Pong to this year of, I'll call them weird custom games, Pong, video pinball. Video pinball was a good game, but market-wise, it was a little bit of a turkey. The only one that was worse was a thing called video music. And Atari did a video music chip. The idea was it would create fancy pictures on your TV when you put music. Market research said that we could sell 30,000 of them. Manufacturing said, well, we're going to release chips for 10,000, but we're only going to build 500. I think we sold 6 at full price. It was... wow, it was a face plant. Every once in a while, if you're out in the sticks somewhere in a cheap motel and you go under the cable TV, you'll actually see a video music playing various music to load up a channel. But that's the only thing it's ever been good for. Then we did the pinball machine. Do you want me to tell you a secret about I figured out that we could not compete with Chicago in the pinball business. We had at least $100 cost of goods sold disparity between, I mean, Chicago had manufacturing, die stamping, what have you. And we also had a freight disadvantage that if you were shipping from California to New York, probably had $100 there too. And so if you had a one-player pinball, two-player pinball, four-player pinball, it was pretty much generic pricing. You couldn't really jump that much from it. And so I said, the only way we can enter the pinball business is in the non-standard or novelty pinball business, because we have to get a bounty on innovation. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense for us. And so we created the wide body pinball, and we were able to get enough extra margin, higher price, in order to pay for that cost differential. And we did several pinballs, and they were pretty successful. They earned good money. They were bigger. A lot of people loved them. They earned more. And so we had a business going. And then I sold to a Warner, and all the people kept saying, well, why don't you do a regular pinball as well? And Warner, after I left, decided that they would do a regular pinball. And I was just shaking my head because I said, you know, these clowns, how could they possibly do that? Don't they understand that we have $200 disadvantage, and that if you tried to get into the standard business, you would have a marginal business at best? I think they produced three pinballs that were regular pinballs and then closed the division, because the economics just didn't make sense to do a pinball in those days. But anyway, just thought I'd pass that along since you guys like pinballs. And I like pinballs too. I mean, I love them. Did you know that first contract with Bally was not just for driving the game, but for a pinball design? And we created a three-level pinball for Bally that was Earth, Heaven, and Hell. And what it was, there was a shooter, you know, a plunger that was in a play field that was about this width big, but the ball would go all on the side, and it was in greens and browns and just sort of earth tones, and the play was kind of fun, and if you hit a certain spot, you'd be banished to hell, which would drop you to this play field below that had extremely active bumpers, and it was all in reds and oranges and yellows, and it was very, very active. And then if it drained, then it'd come back up to the regular, the earth level. And then, of course, if you hit some of the specials, then the ball, it wasn't physically there. It would just go into a captured hole, and then there'd be a new ball that would be launched up into heaven. And it was a very oblique play field. The ball was ethereal. It was in blues and golds and whites. And I thought it was really a cool pinball. Bally never produced it, but win some, lose some. I mean, the number of games that we've designed that have never gotten produced, it just drives me batshit, because some of them are really good, I think. Because I believe that the only arbiter really should be the public. And you got to take some chances sometimes. How much time do I have? Can I keep going for a while? Do you want? Okay. About in the late 1975, I got thinking, you know, we're selling these coin-op games. I think our prices were up to about $1,500, $2,000 at the time. And I thought to myself, we're selling these games for $2,000 bucks. And during their life, they'll earn 30 or 40,000. I'm on the wrong side of this equation. So I thought, self, I want to be in the operating business. But I don't want to compete with my operators. I don't want to compete with the people that I'm selling games to. So I have to create my own location. So I said, okay, I'm going to create an arcade, and I'm going to attach a restaurant as a life support system. And if you've ever tasted Chuck E. Pizza, you know what I'm talking about. It's kind of an afterthought. But I felt that I needed another gimmick. And the most successful pizza parlor in the area was called Pizza and Pipes. And it was great, but they had to have an organist, and they had an old Wurlitzer organ that had been sort of dissembled around on the walls. And I thought to myself, okay, I can't grow a big business on an antique pipe organ, so I have to make a whole bunch of hoo-ha that I can replicate. So I went to an IAAPA show, an amusement park show, and found a costume. And the costume was for Coyote Pizza. And Coyote Pizza was what we were going to do, and we were going to have a sort of a show, Roadrunner Coyote kind of thing. And took it back, took it into engineering, said, make this guy talk. And a couple of weeks later, came back and says, how's the coyote doing? He says, what coyote? And I said, the coyote costume I gave you. And he says, that's not coyote, it's a rat. And I said, well, it was kind of a caricature, you know, and I kind of thought it was a coyote. He says, well, you know, coyotes don't have big pink tails. So I had a real problem. I could either delay the project and find a coyote visage, because I knew my engineers could make guys talk, I just didn't think they could make them look like a coyote. And so at that point in time, I said, okay, Rick Rat's Pizza. Went into the marketing department, and they said, that is a disaster. Says, this is a restaurant. Rats are dirty. You will lose your health thing. And I said, okay, well, what should we, could it be a rat, but we kind of de-emphasize his ratness? And they said, yeah, maybe that'll work. And I said, well, I just don't want to delay the project. We've leased a facility. We're ready to go. You know, let's do it. You name it. And so they came back and said, we've got a great name. I said, what is it? He says, it's a three-smile name. I said, what is it? Chuck E. Cheese. And so that's how Chuck E. got... That's how Coyote Pizza turned into Chuck E. Cheese. Anyway, okay, what else can we talk about for a minute? That's good, Chuck E. I did Anderbot, E-Tac. That's my light. Let me tell you a little bit about Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs had passion. He was one of the few employees that I'd find curled up on his... on a futon that he kept under his desk. He was meticulous. He was the best solderer that we ever had. He came to work as a technician. In fact, he came to my office one time and said, Nolan, the soldering in this company sucks. And he brought a board in, and yes, about a third of the solder joints were cold solder joints, and those are the ones that end up failing after a while. And I said, well, Steve, go ahead and fix it. And we ended up getting to be pretty good friends. But Steve was obnoxious. If he thought you were dumb, he would say, you are dumb shit, and I don't want to listen to it. That's not a good strategy if you're saying that to your boss. And so I always felt that there is a place in a company for misfits. and people who are capable, and but maybe don't have perfect social skills. That's a mild statement. Steve didn't like to bathe either, which was another serious problem. So I decided the solution was to put Steve on the night shift, the engineering night shift that didn't previously exist. And so the whole idea was having there, but also Wozniak, and I knew he and Wozniak were great friends, and I knew that if Steve was on the night shift, Woz would be there too. So I looked at it as hiring two Steves for the price of one. And Wozniak was an absolute savant, and still is. And he was able to do some wonderful things. And so here we came along to Breakout. Now, you guys will understand this better, but paddle games were considered death. It was over, that ship had sailed, and we were in the middle of other kinds of games. But I wanted to do Breakout, and I just knew it was going to be a fun game, but it happened to be a ball and paddle game. So I couldn't get any of my engineers interested in doing it. And we sort of had this meritocracy to where engineers could decide on their projects and all that stuff. So I signed it to Jobs. And I knew Wozniak was going to do part of it. And so I set up a thing where if they can get it done in a big hurry, because we needed something for the show, for the AMOA that fall, and I wanted Breakout to be part of it. And so I gave them a bonus, and it turned out that they earned $5,000 bonus. It was a little more than I thought, but they did a better job on reducing the chip count. And the reason I bring this up, because probably 15 years later, Woz was sitting in my kitchen, and we were talking about the good old days, and I said, "What did you do with your half of the $5,000?" He says, $5,000? I said, for the Breakout. He shook his head and says, "That son of a bitch did it to me again." Jobs told Woz that the bonus was $500, and he gave Woz $250. But anyway, life marches on. But you know, Woz was really good. He says, "You know, I don't really regret that." He says, "Jobs, I would have been an engineer, happy to give away all this because I liked the technology. It was Jobs that saw the business opportunity for it and put it all together." And so, you know, it's very interesting how people blend in certain ways and create some remarkable stuff. And of course, that was about the time I turned down a third of Apple for $50,000. Yeah, I really do regret that. But I did introduce Jobs to Valentine, who introduced him to Mike Markle, who ended up putting in the money and becoming the first president of Apple, and provided what I'd call the mentoring and the adult leadership that turned Jobs and Wozniak into businessmen. So, you know, we've all seen what Back to the Future is, and if you change things, you may change everything. It could have been that if I had invested, I would have lost it, an Apple computer wouldn't have been invented. I say that late at night. I did buy video later on in Axlon and Magna Microwave, U-Inc. I've got some other stuff here. Let me talk a little bit. Geez, what did I do this? Oh, this is a fun one. Augmented reality. This is going to be an area for games in the future. And augmented reality, a lot of people have seen the Google Glass and that sort of thing. I think that essentially the world can be a wonderful gaming environment. but you need to have a computer overlay. But in order to really do a good computer overlay, you need not just X, Y, and Z, plus or minus a few centimeters, but you need phi, rho, and theta. So for those of you who aren't engineers, there's a scalar, that is a point in space, and then there's a vector, which is a direction in space. And so X, Y, Z puts you there, phi, rho, theta puts you there. Once you know that, then you can do overlays of graphics any way you want to. And so that you can be walking down the street. Oh, here we go. X, Y, Z, phi, rho, theta. And the accelerometers and gyroscopes only get you so far right now. But see, you can do things like this that can be kind of fun. And then there's a thing. I want you to watch a technology called Project Tango from Google. And they have an ability to go in, scan this room. It takes you about 2 minutes. Once you have that down, this tablet knows plus or minus 5 centimeters, plus or minus 2 degrees, phi, rho, and theta, where it's looking. So if you look at this room through the tablet, it can be anything your software wants. For example, this can be a medieval banquet hall, and all of you people can be frogs. You've always wanted that. But more than that, did you know that on an alternative plane, this room is filled with evil monkeys? The evil monkeys are here because you know that whenever you put earphones in your pocket and you pull out the cord, they're all tangled up. Evil monkeys. And so through these devices, you can now go around. You can identify the evil monkeys, push them into another dimension, and get rid of them as a benefit to mankind. These are some of the fun things that I think you'll be seeing very, very shortly. You have these, this, guild game wagering, virtual goods. Oh, geez. Just a second. This is commercial. I just wrote this book, and it's about how to create organizations that excel in creativity, because Atari essentially won because we out-created everything. We were the most creative, and that ultimately won. Apple is the largest market cap company in the world because they were the most creative, fundamentally. I mean, Bally, everybody had more cash, better manufacturing, more intense marketing, and presence in the marketplace than we did. And in 5 years, we had a 95% market share of world video game sales. And what that does is shows you the power that innovation can be. Of course, we did some dirty tricks, too. You know how the people were copying Pong? We had copiers that would buy our first games, Xerox the PC board, and sometimes be in the market within 3 months of when we started manufacturing. I decided I was going to run them out of business. I think that's a worthy goal. Competition is about creating a monopoly. Anyway, we were a volume customer from our semiconductor supplier, so I asked them to mark the chips in a certain way. So there's a serial number, but a regular part number. I messed up the part numbers so that our quad NAND gate chip was actually a flip-flop and vice versa. So that if they just read the chips and ordered the parts, they'd populate the circuit boards and they wouldn't work. The nice thing about it is, as you know, in the coin-op business, once a game has been into the market to the point where the new game is earning more, the market for the old game goes essentially to zero. So I figured if I could just slow any of our potential copiers down so that all they had was a warehouse full of unsaleable, non-working inventory, that would be good. So we did that, and we had three competitors, copiers, in Silicon Valley. And the day that one of them declared bankruptcy, we held a champagne party on the front lawn. Now, I don't know if that's a dirty trick, but we invited them. So anyway, I want you all to get my latest book, Finding the Next Steve Jobs. I think if you get several, it's really good because you can eat them for breakfast. Let's see. There's some of the things about failure in the dice game, and I think I'm going to get over it. Oh, how many have been to Burning Man? Burning Man. It's a great party, and for people who are in the creative business, it's a very creative environment. It's great fun, and you can have fun there even if you don't do drugs. Then there's Google I.O., CES. These are all things that if you add to your repertoire, it unburdens, it enables your creativity juices, and I really highly expect that. Comic-Con. Now, if you want to hang out with serious crazies, it's a good thing. And some of the crazies really have great ideas. Now, look at this guy in the blue space outfit. How long do you think it took him to build that puppy? You know? And then, of course, you can never go bad with Wonder Woman there. Google Glasses, all that. Oh, let me tell you a video game that you're going to be doing. This is Project Tango. I was talking about that. But I want to talk about... This is an old slideshow, pre-ISO, that you know, I'm supposed to be shorter than. But now that you guys are letting me ramble on, I could have put some of this in. But anyway, the next biggest opportunity for the video game business is actually the auto-drive cars. If you don't have to see outside, all of a sudden your windscreen and all your windows can actually be video displays. So that instead of driving down, you know, Wacker Drive, you can be driving down a western town, and there's a bank robbery going on, and cattle rustlers. Or you can be driving down Wacker Drive, and it's actually on Mars, or in a future universe, or during the Blitz in London. It can be historical. It can be hysterical. And the whole idea of it will be very, very interesting. Now, the auto-drive car is going to change everything. It'll change the way everybody lives, because travel will be part of your existence. It'll be fun. You'll be able to get home totally hammered. And... you know, think what that's going to do for the bar restaurant business. The next thing that you can do is there are no traffic jams anymore. Auto-drive cars can go nose to tail at 90 miles to 100 miles an hour. And there's a benefit there, because only the first car has to break the wind resistance. So everybody's gas mileage goes way up, but by that time it'll be very much electrical. And because the car can be precise in the lane, they can just drop a drag strip charge up some ultracapacitors that you can charge instantaneously, and then it'll bleed off into your regular batteries, and you can have a totally electrified system in most cities with less than 35 pounds of batteries, which says that you, and since you don't have collisions anymore, because most of the collisions you ever have are from inadvertence, you can have an ultralight car that should have gas or energy usage that's over 100 miles a gallon. Now, think about the fact that every lane is 20 times, can handle 20 times as much traffic. That says that we have 3 to 5 times more highway capacity than we need. Now, think of mass transit. Mass transit totally goes away. The cost of a mile in New York City is $3.40. It charges per ride $2.50. The rest of it's government subsidies. The cost of an auto drive taxi per mile is 35 cents. So any cab company that uses auto drive cabs can now provide cab service for 55, 60 cents. Why would you ever want to get underground? You say, but that'll cause traffic jams. I said, no, previous slide, no traffic jams. You can take all the people out of mass transit and put them in an auto drive taxi. Now, you lose something. When you're on the subway, you meet interesting people. You deal with the reality of the human condition, and sometimes you catch a disease. But other than that, there's no problem. Anyway, I got to tell you one more thing. All these cabs will have a little compartment that's about a half a meter by a half a meter by a half a meter. It will have the ability to be automatically injected into the car at a kiosk at every corner or taken out. And so now when I want to have a package delivered to me, you just put it in that container, put the address on it, and it will, when you turn right and the package is going left, it'll just deposit it in one of these kiosks. The next car that's going by that's going in the right direction will pick it up. It's a packet switch network for things, which will drop the cost of shipping the last mile, which is where all the cost is, to about a tenth of what it is today. I think that's really cool. Anyway, okay, I ramble on that one. What else are we going to do here? Oh, I don't know if you noticed, but Uber just got an investment at a $14.8 billion valuation. Why? It's because everybody believes that Uber will be the software infrastructure for the auto drive cars that will be starting to be deployed within 2 years. Now, it's not just Google. Turns out that BMW, Audi, Mercedes, Toyota, Ford have actually more hands-free miles than Google does. This is happening. It's going to happen fast. It's going to be massively disruptive. Let's see. What else? Here we go. Oh, this is just some things. They're splicing plants with Firefly DNA and photoplankton so that we'll have parks within the next few years that will look like Avatar. If you like that sort of thing. This is an actual photograph of some mushrooms with photo stuff. Games come immersive, all that, 3D printing. You can actually build houses now using 3D printing mechanisms. Probably somewhere, three-bedroom house, cost to manufacture, somewhere between $4,000 and $7,000. So innovation is no longer an option. Let's make it happen. Thank you very much. I appreciate the honor.